Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. We hope you're all having an enjoyable holiday weekend. Today, we'll have a recap of activities honoring the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. around San Diego and the nation. Plus, we'll be broadcasting a speech by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder on civil rights issues, how far we've come, and how far we still have to go as a nation. Holder will also announce some reforms the Justice Department is making to address concerns over violence by police and violence directed at police. On Jobs Talk, we'll have news about the president's proposal to require paid sick leave for workers. And then on Green Scene, hear about a fire at the Ocotillo Wind Energy Facility. On Crime Beat, we'll have some chilling details about two tragic deaths on the Barona Reservation in Lakeside and an arrest for double murder. We'll tell you about some reforms that Michael Picker, the new president of the California Utilities Commission, is rolling out to stop backdoor dealings between utility companies and state regulators. From Public News Service, learn why the Colorado River is a vital part of Southern California's economy. And in Ramona, we'll have information on efforts to ramp up plans for a skate park there. Plus, hear about a major new energy project that just went online in East County. We'll end our show today with a replay of our interview with talented young singer-songwriter Danny Marie, an East County rising star who has a performance coming up soon at the House of Blues. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. San Diegans honored the memory of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. this weekend with the city's annual Martin Luther King Day Parade. Over in Lemon Grove, the Martin Luther King Jr. Choir performed a free community concert. And in City Heights, San Diegans joined in a national four-mile march held in cities around the nation to build a new civil rights movement and draw attention to lives lost through police violence, an issue that remains relevant today as it was during the turbulent times a half century ago when Dr. King led civil rights marches around the nation to seek equality for all Americans. Kathy Mendonca with United Against Police Terror says there is no question that Martin Luther King Jr. stood for justice and equality. We believe that he would fight for police reform and the right for fair treatment of all human beings if he were alive today, she says. By marching on his observance day, we seek to both honor the legacy of Dr. King and to remind the nation that the fight for justice and equality is far from over. Next up on our Capitol Report, we'll tell you about what U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder had to say on those issues and more, including his announcement of reforms. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. In a speech at a Justice Department ceremony on Thursday, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder honored slain civil rights leader Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
It is a pleasure, as always, to join so many valued colleagues and good friends in paying tribute to the enduring legacy of an extraordinary leader, in celebrating the contributions of a singular figure in our nation's history, and in honoring the memory of a lifelong champion for equality, for peace, and for justice, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Holder also acknowledged civil rights leader Dorianne Ladner, who organized the Freedom Summer Project, participated in many civil rights marches, including Selma, Alabama, and was once arrested for helping to integrate a Woolworth's lunch counter in a now famous civil rights incident.
I also want to extend a truly heartfelt special welcome to civil rights leader Dorianne Ladner, who we are honored to have with us today. Ma'am, but for you, I would not be the Attorney General of the United States. Barack Obama would not be President of the United States. Thank you.
Then he spoke about Dr. King's legacy and the work that remains to be done.
And I particularly want to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to participate in this annual event on what should have been today, Dr. King's 86th birthday. As we join millions of our fellow citizens throughout the country in remembering the man who helped to lead a really sweeping movement that forever changed the face of America and inspired people around the world to reach for opportunity and to reach for inclusion. The remarkable and enduring achievements of the civil rights era in tearing down segregationist policies, expanding access to the ballot box, and enshrining key protections into law did nothing less than alter the course of history. The impact of the movement has been transformative, and its power impossible to measure over the last five decades. Yet, as we've been reminded all too clearly in recent months, despite this once unimaginable progress, there's no denying, as we gather for this important commemoration, that a great deal of work remains to be done. Even today, in 2015, our journey is not yet complete. Economic progress remains uneven. Educational opportunity is still not uniform. And with due respect to the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, the right to vote is under siege. And we continue to live in a world that's too often divided, a world riven by misunderstanding and despair, a world beset by momentous challenges that are old and that are new, and a world badly in need of the compassion, the inclusion, and the healing that Dr. King stood for and worked toward throughout his too short 39 years. Now, especially in this time of trial, it is not only fitting, it is essential that we rededicate ourselves to the vision and the values that guided Dr. King at every stage of his career. Today, just as they did 50 years ago, these values point us away from tired rhetoric and stale talking points. They move us toward open dialogue and constructive engagement. They impel us to remember the common humanity that Dr. King found in every person that he met, in police officers as well as in protesters, in prisoners as well as in presidents. And they call us to the service of our fellow citizens, the betterment of our nation, and the protection of all that is exceptionable about the country that we love. After all, as Dr. King once said, everybody can be great because everybody can serve.
He then spent most of the rest of his speech speaking about the need to improve relations between police and communities of color and to improve race relations in America, along with some specific steps that his department will be taking. And we're going to play the balance of the Attorney General's speech for you in its entirety now.
Now, I am mindful as we come together this morning that there are few who answer this call to greatness more heroically and fewer who make more contributions and sacrifices in the name of public service than those who stand on the front lines of our fight for public safety, America's brave men and women in law enforcement. Now, as the brother of a retired police officer, I know in a very personal way that these courageous individuals perform their difficult and dangerous jobs with really extraordinary valor, compassion, and honor. They serve as steadfast guardians of our rights and our liberties, shouldering tremendous and often unheralded burdens. They incur significant risks in order to keep the rest of us safe, and they are routinely called upon to make split-second decisions to protect themselves and those around them. In short, they are true American heroes whose patriotism, integrity, and commitment to the highest standards of excellence are simply beyond question. I know this, and I have been troubled and deeply disturbed by recent mischaracterizations of this administration's regard for those who wear the badge. Over the past 6 years, our record of support for law enforcement has been both strong and unambiguous. This Justice Department, under my leadership, has taken significant and in some cases unprecedented steps to protect and to empower our local, state, tribal, and federal law enforcement colleagues. This is simple fact. In 2011, I created an officer safety working group in response to concerns about officer-directed violence. Through groundbreaking initiatives like Valor, the Department of Justice is providing cutting-edge training to help prevent violence against law enforcement. to improve officer resilience and to increase survivability during violent encounters. And we're currently funding through analysis of our 2014 officer fatalities, including ambushes and other incidents, so that we can mitigate risks going forward. Under our Bulletproof Vest Partnership Program, we're helping to provide life-saving equipment to those who serve on the front lines. And through programs like the Public Safety Officers Benefit Program, we're offering our strongest support to brave officers and their loved ones during the toughest of times. Now, as someone who knows firsthand the pride of seeing a family member in uniform and the anguish that comes with knowing a loved one is in harm's way out patrolling the street, my personal support for those who serve has been steadfast throughout my career. I believe that every law enforcement officer is deserving not merely of our utmost respect, but our deepest gratitude. And that's why last month's devastating and barbaric attack, which claimed the lives of two of New York's finest, officers Liu and Ramos, was so shocking and so deplorable. Now, these senseless murders were assaults on all of us, on our nation, on the rule of law, and on everyone who stands for justice. They serve as tragic reminders of the dangers that all of our police officers regularly face. And they have lent new urgency to our ongoing national conversation about the need to reduce crime, while at the same time building public trust wherever it has been eroded. This afternoon, I'm going to be traveling to Philadelphia to convene the latest in a series of roundtable discussions with law enforcement leaders, elected officials, community members, young people, and civil rights advocates in order to keep advancing this dialogue. Now, over the course of my travels throughout the country, I've had the chance to discuss these critical issues with Americans of all ages, backgrounds, races, ethnicities, and walks of life, from Atlanta to Cleveland, from Memphis to Chicago. I've heard from police officers, from protesters, faith leaders, and concerned citizens. On many occasions, I've been deeply moved by the stories and perspectives that I've heard, from parents hoping to secure brighter and safer futures for their children, from passionate young people becoming engaged in our national debate, from police officers valiantly putting their lives on the line to make our neighborhoods just a bit safer. Now, through all of these interactions, I've really been struck not by the differences that have emerged, but by the remarkable commonalities, by the desire for peace, for safety, and for justice that drives everyone who's engaged in this discussion, and by the shared vision of a better tomorrow and a more secure and inclusive future that unites all Americans. Now, let me be very clear. None of these goals are in tension. None of our aims are in conflict. And so it is incumbent upon all of us to protect both the safety of our police officers and the rights and well-being of all of our citizens. We can and we must examine new ways to do both. Now, the first step to achieving this is to obtain better, more accurate data on the scope of the challenges that we face. Now, for instance, I've heard from a number of people who have called on policymakers to ensure better record keeping on injuries and deaths that occur at the hands of police. I've also spoken with law enforcement leaders, including the leadership of the Fraternal Order of Police, who have urged elected officials to consider strategies for collecting better data on officer fatalities. Well, today, my response to these legitimate concerns is simple. We need to do both. This would represent a common sense step that would begin to address serious concerns about police officer safety as well as the need to safeguard civil liberties. The troubling reality is that we lack the ability right now to comprehensively track the number of incidents of either uses of force directed at police officers or uses of force by police. There has been some effort to address this in the past. In the 1990s, for example, Congress enacted legislation intended to help the Justice Department collect data on officer-involved shootings. But since the reporting remains optional and perhaps lacks sufficient incentives, many localities do not provide this data. Likewise, absent a requirement for reporting of injuries and deaths of police officers, many localities fail to report these statistics as well. Now, this strikes many, including me, as unacceptable. Fixing this is an idea that we should all be able to unite behind. Now, on a more fundamental level, our shared objectives also require that we work together to confront the mistrust that exists in some places between law enforcement officers and the communities that they serve. This is why President Obama and I have announced a variety of proposals that will enable us to bridge those divides wherever they are uncovered, from a national initiative for building community trust and justice to new funding for body-worn cameras. In recent weeks, I've also announced improvements to racial profiling guidance that applies to all federal law enforcement agents conducting law enforcement activities. And the President has taken the historic step of convening a new task force on 21st century policing, which held its first hearing just 2 days ago, in which, under the leadership of Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey, former Assistant Attorney General Lori Robinson, and other law enforcement leaders and experts, will provide strong national direction to the profession as a whole, on a scale not seen since the Johnson administration. Now, I want to emphasize that these reforms are not aimed at individual officers themselves, who perform their jobs with distinction each and every day. Rather, they are intended to strengthen the criminal justice system as a whole, as well as the policies and procedures that shape this system and govern the way that it functions. This will improve public confidence, allowing law enforcement to operate with maximum safety, effectiveness, fairness, and legitimacy in every case and in every circumstance. And it will help to ensure that our present dialogue can be translated into positive, meaningful action. We owe it to our brave law enforcement officers, to peaceful demonstrators, and especially to our youngest citizens, to talk forthrightly about the issues that we face, no matter how difficult or complex they may be. We owe it to ourselves and our nation to seek areas of consensus rather than to exploit old divisions and to reopen wounds. Most of all, we owe it to those who throughout history have fought and sacrificed and given their lives to bring our country to this moment, from Dr. King and the pioneers of the civil rights era, as well as to Officers Ramos and Liu and the colleagues who carry on their work, to lay aside meaningless grievances, to reject political posturing from those who only demonstrate their interest in front of television cameras, and to do everything in our power to confront the challenges of our time and find a way to move forward together. During my visit to Memphis last month, I had the opportunity to tour the National Civil Rights Museum at the Lorraine Motel. Each and every one of you should go there. This is where Dr. King's room is preserved, just as it was on April the 4th, 1968, the night that he was taken from us by the very same forces of intolerance against which he had stood throughout his life. I could not help but think, as I stood on that motel balcony, about this great leader's unshakable belief that promoting love and condemning all forms of violence is the only way to cut off the chain of hate. I thought as well of the words of my predecessor as Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, who spoke about Dr. King's legacy in what he called the mindless menace of violence just one day after Dr. King's untimely murder. In that emotional speech, then Senator Kennedy urged a grieving nation to remember, and I quote, that the victims of violence are black and white, rich and poor, young and old, famous and unknown. And he reminded us that no matter where they came from or who they were in life, all of these victims were human beings whom other human beings loved and needed. Well, as we gather today in the shadow of recent acts of senseless violence, I cannot help but reflect on the lives that have been lost over the past few months in communities where tragic deaths have exposed rifts between citizens and law enforcement. In New York City, where two brave police officers were murdered because of the uniforms that they wore. And in Paris, where heinous and cowardly acts of terror shocked the world and targeted the freedoms that we all hold so dear. Unfortunately, none of this is new to us. Senseless violence has coursed through the veins of this world for ages. And we have seen throughout history that acts of hatred breed only hatred. We understand that words of division only deepen division. And we know that our most serious and systemic challenges continue to demand the very best of us, just as they did in Dr. King's time. So today, once again, let us not shy away from, but embrace the noisy discord of honest, frank, and vigorous debate. Never forget, this great nation was born of protest by residents of this land who took to the streets to demand fairness from those who govern them. Let us never fail to support those who wear the badge, or to work alongside them in building a constructive dialogue, a dialogue founded on our common humanity. Let us act on the crucial recognition that those who serve with honor serve greatly, and they deserve our deepest respect. And let us reject the empty rhetoric of anyone who would engage in cynical attempts to divide and to cast blame, choosing instead to affirm once more that Americans from all backgrounds and perspectives must come together to be part of positive change. In this great nation, a nation of laws and of high ideals, we have always had the power to forge our own future. Dr. King's example offers inspiring proof of this fact. And that's why, as our present work unfolds, so long as we continue to rely on the engagement of our citizens, the ongoing commitment of our police officers, and the singular expertise and experience of leaders like you, I believe that there is good reason for confidence in where this effort will take us. So I want to thank you all once again for your dedication to this work. Wherever I am and whatever I am doing, I will always be proud to count you all as colleagues and partners in the work of making better the nation that we all love. I want to thank you all for all that you have done for me for these past 6 years and for all that you will do for our nation in the years ahead. Thank you.
You are listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Welcome to East County Magazine Show's Jobs Talk, bringing you news about great jobs, job training opportunities, and growing our regional economy.
President Barack Obama is calling on Congress to pass the Healthy Families Act, which would require businesses to provide up to 7 paid sick leave days each year for their employees. He also encourages state and local governments to do the same if Congress fails to act. In addition, the president announced he is instructing federal agencies to allow up to 6 weeks of paid leave to take care of a new child or ailing family member. He is also asking Congress to pass a law that would allow an additional 6 weeks of paid parental leave. The president will ask Congress for $2 billion to encourage states to develop paid leave programs as well. Many states, such as California, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, already have paid leave programs. However, over 43 million Americans are without any paid sick days. This often forces workers to come to work while ill, which risks infecting co-workers and customers. Lack of paid sick time may also force parents to send their sick children to school because they cannot stay home to care for them. The bill is drawing opposition from some Republicans who say the government will be forcing regulation on businesses that can't afford it. Tim Warstall, a contributor to Forbes, claims the bill will result in lower wages. According to him, the bill is also unnecessary because those who value the ability to take paid sick leave presumably have self-sorted themselves into jobs where they get it, and those that don't, haven't. Obama says the bill is ultimately going to make our economy stronger, the Washington Post reports. He also states that there will be benefits for businesses, such as decreased employee turnover. Reporting for KNSJ, this is Hayden Parsley.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a report about a fire at Pattern Energy's Ocotillo Wind Energy Facility on Thursday, January 15th. A wind turbine manufactured by the Siemens Company burst into flames. East County Magazine photographer Jim Pelley, who lives in Ocotillo, recorded the fire on video, and you can view it on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. The cause of the fire is under investigation, Jeff Grappone from Siemens told East County Magazine. A circuit with 6 turbines has been de-energized as a precaution. The fire department responded, however, the fire burned itself out without intervention. The turbine that caught fire is on an old mining road in the desert and is not near homes. But residents have raised concerns about what could happen if the turbines have a defect and if a future fire should occur, whirling off burning debris near homes that stand just 500 feet away from some wind turbines in the project. Park Ewing, an Ocotillo resident living near turbines, also voiced concern over whether toxins were released by smoke from the blaze. This is not the first serious incident at the Ocotillo Wind Facility, where, among other concerns, a multi-ton blade fell off in May 2013, as we reported. The Ocotillo Wind Project is located in desert terrain where fire poses less of a hazard than in places with dense brush, such as Campo in San Diego's East County, where a fire at the Kumeyaay Wind Farm in December 2013 sparked a brush fire that burned very close to a home, panicking residents before it was extinguished. A prior explosion at that same Campo Wind Facility in December 2010 resulted in replacement of all 25 turbines, which were offline for months. The Campo project was developed by Babcock & Brown, the corporate predecessor of Pattern Energy, which built Ocotillo. Asked whether the turbine manufacturer, Siemens, has had fires at other wind projects elsewhere, Grappone replied, "We have a strong fire resistance track record with very few isolated incidents affecting our global fleet of more than 6,800 of this type of turbine in operation." Pattern Energy, which developed the Ocotillo Wind Project, claimed in a community meeting in January 2010 that turbine fires are extremely rare, as we recorded on videotape back then. However, an East County Magazine investigation last year documented hundreds of wind turbine fires around the world, including one that sparked a wildfire burning several hundred acres in Southern California recently and another that shut down a freeway in Palm Springs. An Australia fire sparked by a wind turbine burned thousands of acres. While it's true that the percentage of turbines that explode remains statistically small, it only takes one to potentially ignite a devastating wildfire in a region such as San Diego's East County, where Santa Ana winds have fueled the two worst wildfires in California history in 2003 and 2007. An East County Magazine readers poll back in 2012 found that 51% of our readers, the majority, would support a ban prohibiting industrial-scale wind turbines in wildfire-prone East County, while only 42% would oppose such a ban and 7% were not sure. But that poll was taken before a spate of serious wind turbine fires in Southern California and San Diego County drew media attention in our region, burning away the wind industry's long-standing argument that neighbors of wind farms need not be concerned about a wind turbine exploding, starting a wildfire, or putting nearby homes and lives at risk.
This is Leon Thompson with a Crime Beat report. A SWAT standoff in Lakeside on Friday ended in a gruesome discovery and the arrest of Elena Rose Welch on double murder charges, the Sheriff's Homicide Unit reports. Sheriff's deputies initially responded to a call shortly after noon from Welch stating that her child was dead. Barona Tribal Enforcement received a radio call soon after reporting an attempted suicide at the home on Quincy Canyon Road in Lakeside. When Barona officers arrived, they spoke with Welch's boyfriend, who went back inside the house. Moments later, a gunshot was heard. Welch emerged carrying a shotgun, which she dropped on a road outside. The man was found dead of a gunshot wound to the chest. Authorities found the body of an approximately 3-year-old child in the freezer in the garage underneath frozen food. Cause of death will be determined by the medical examiner. Welch, who is 32 years old, was arrested and taken to the Las Colinas detention facility. The tragedy prompted a shutdown of San Vicente Road and a lockdown of the charter school on the Barona Reservation Friday afternoon.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians. The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
taking the helm of the scandal-ridden California Public Utilities Commission, or CPUC, new President Michael Picker announced reforms last week aimed at ending backdoor access by utilities to state regulators, as well as plans to improve transparency. His predecessor, Michael Peavy, resigned in December amid a public outcry over Peavy's too cozy relations with utilities on major matters, including liability for the San Bruno pipeline explosion and the future of the San Onofre nuclear facility. Picker said emails showing easy access by utilities to decision makers are, quote, troubling and very painful to read. He observed that the emails raised uncertainties as to whether the CPUC is being fair and even-handed in its decisions. At the first Public Utilities Commission meeting that he chaired, Picker said of those backdoor communications, what I can do as president is to make sure that does not happen again. He also cited serious concerns about a lack of safety oversight by the commission and pledged reforms. The scandals under Peavy's reign have resulted in state and federal investigations. Picker said the commission is cooperating in those probes, which potentially could result in criminal charges against his predecessor or staff. Emails revealed back-channel communications between Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, and Peavy's chief of staff seeking to limit the utility's liability for the San Bruno pipeline disaster, which killed 8 people and leveled a full city block. Peavy had earlier appeared to also offer favorable treatment to PG&E in exchange for contributions to a ballot measure and a party funded for CPUC officials. In addition, a UT San Diego investigation found Peavy violated commission rules by setting up secret meetings in 2013 with a Southern California Edison attorney in London, who called Peavy a great friend while the Public Utilities Commission was deliberating issues related to the San Onofre nuclear facilities and the costs for ratepayers. On a related note, last week, a CPUC administrative law judge, Amy Yip Kikugawa, ordered PG&E to publicly release 65,000 emails between the utility and the PUC in response to the City of San Bruno's request for communications about that San Bruno gas line explosion. Picker revealed that the PUC has also released emails between Peavy and Southern California Edison requested by a San Diego law firm. He did not name the firm. However, former city attorney Mike Aguirre's law firm had sought extensive records. Peavy became agitated during a public hearing when Aguirre grilled him publicly on his communications with Edison, ordering Aguirre to, quote, shut up. Picker announced that the PUC has hired Michael Strumwasser of Strumwasser and Wucher as an independent expert to review best practices that the commission should adopt. Then he disclosed, we have also banned one utility, PG&E, from all ex parte communications. To further expand transparency, new reporting procedures will require that communications between certain PUC staff and regulated entities, such as utilities, will be reported to the public. Are you ready for this? Online, every single week. That's right. You can now go online to check out those records yourself, and so can the media. Picker also pledged to comply with a mountain of public records requests, which he confirmed are retained in the agency's archive back to mid-2010. And, he said, we will move the agency forward with openness and transparency. Picker made clear that if there is a prohibition on having a conversation with somebody, I don't have it, and I expect the same of my fellow commissioners. He added, rebuilding the PUC into an organization that is more fair, open, and accessible and effective must start at the top. He vowed to develop a commissioner code of ethics that all the members must sign, and to form committees to hold public meetings on further reforms to improve accountability and measure improvement. Picker also touted plans to improve public safety, though that plan was in the works before he took the helm. He cited a slow erosion of safety programs in recent years, notably gas pipeline safety, but he praised commission staff for increasing its oversight of rail shipments of hazardous crude oil. He also addressed the changing energy market, noting that customer adoption of rooftop solar and electric vehicles is creating a marketplace where the commission's jurisdiction is no longer all-encompassing. As a result, the CPUC will need to adjust its operations to address these trends and carry out its role in the governor's greenhouse gas reduction program, Peavy stated. Peavy is the former senior advisor for renewable energy to Governor Jerry Brown and served since January 2014 as a CPUC commissioner before asking Brown to appoint him to head the commission. Governor Brown himself has drawn criticism for failing to speak out about utilities' undue influence over regulators at the PUC. The governor's sister, Kathleen Brown, is currently a director on the board of Sempra Energy, which she was appointed to last year. Sempra is the parent company of San Diego Gas and Electric, or SDG&E, and that has led some to question whether the governor may be placing family loyalties above the public interest. Unlike Peavy, a former senior executive for a major private utility corporation, Picker's background is primarily in public service, including serving as Deputy Treasurer of California and Deputy Assistant for Toxic Substance Control in the governor's office. He has also served on the board of directors for the publicly owned Sacramento Municipal Utility District, and Picker holds a master's degree from UC Davis, specializing in marketing, social marketing, and nonprofit management, a stark contrast to the corporate background of his predecessor. On his first day at the helm of the Public Utilities Commission, President Picker concluded, "I am confident that working together and making real changes in how we do business will result in a stronger CPUC that robustly serves the interests of the people of California and helps us improve safety in all the industries we regulate." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A little more than half the economy of Southern California is dependent in some way on the health of the Colorado River system. That's the finding of a new report that quantifies the value of the river to the seven western states that use it. Researchers at Arizona State University say about 7 million jobs are affected by industries that use Colorado River water in seven California counties. Kevin Tilden with American Water, a company that manages investor-owned water utilities around the state, says these findings broaden the outlook beyond recreation and farming.
I think when they see the images of the reservoirs at low levels, they think of this boating season or, you know, this growing season of their agriculture. And I think the study says really the economic impact in the trillions of dollars is such that we need to be thinking about the much longer term.
Tilden says in California, the report underscores the importance of the massive water bond passed by voters in November. The research indicates Colorado River water is the lifeblood of many communities, with an overall economic effect of $1.4 trillion across the seven states. It also says federal agencies should do a better job of collecting and reporting water usage data. The report authors say their research is the first of its kind to quantify economic impact to a wide variety of industries, from real estate to healthcare, finance, manufacturing, and more. Economist Tim James at Arizona State says his team created an economic model for each of the seven states in the Colorado Basin and combined them.
And then we work out how much water is entailed in all the different production processes. So it then tells us how much each sector is reliant on water, and then what would happen if that water was no longer available? How much would you be able to produce?
James notes that it's unlikely every drop of Colorado River water would go away, so the study results can be adjusted by percentage of water loss. But demand already exceeds the supply, and the report says even a 10% decrease in available water could mean a hit of more than $143 billion to the basin state. For Public News Service, I'm Chris Thomas.
Efforts are ramping up to build a skate park in Ramona. Ramona Skate Park Champions is a new organization seeking nonprofit status. Its members include residents, parents, local businesses, and skateboarding enthusiasts. Their goal is to raise money for construction of a 16,500-square-foot Ramona Skate Park on Main Street behind the Ramona Library. The site is on county-owned land that's part of the Ramona Intergenerational Community Campus. That means the park would be run by the county's Parks and Recreation Department, and the county would take on liability for the skate park once again. A public meeting on the proposed skate park will be held on Monday, January 19th at 6:30 p.m. at Ramona Town Hall at 729 Main Street in Ramona. The group aims to create a 5-year plan similar to the plan used to build Lakeside Skate Park, which opened last May, the first such facility in the county's unincorporated region. The project supporters include the Tony Hawk Foundation, which has donated over $3.4 million to help build hundreds of skate parks nationwide. The foundation's founder, Tony Hawk, won the National Skateboard Association's World Championship 12 times in a row. The Ramona Skate Park Champions has set up a website at www.ramonaskatepark.org as well as a Facebook page to organize and raise funds. Dwight Webster, media and outreach champion for Ramona Skate Park Champions, acknowledges that the effort will take time, the Ramona Sentinel reports. This will be a long race, he concludes, not a sprint. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
San Diego Gas and Electric Company's new Eco Substation project in East County has been energized and is now in operation, adding a key component to the region's electrical grid. The entire project includes a new 58-acre state-of-the-art substation in Hucumba, an upgraded substation in Boulevard, and a 14-mile transmission line connecting the two substations. According to SDG&E, the Eco Substation project was designed to enhance electric reliability in the region and help facilitate delivery of renewable wind and solar energy to SDG&E's customers. David Gere, Vice President of Electric Transmission and System Engineering for SDG&E, says this project will also help in meeting California's aggressive renewable energy goals by facilitating the development of renewable energy in the region. Construction required nearly 950,000 work hours. SDG&E, a subsidiary of Sempra Energy, reports a safety record at the project with an accident rate 75% lower than the industry's national average for similar construction projects. The Eco Substation project drew controversy, however, among rural residents for using over 90 million gallons of water during construction. That's three times more than SDG&E forecast, leading to fears that groundwater supplies could be strained during the worst drought in California history. Environmentalists and some residents also objected to the massive grading and environmental disruption, as well as potential fire dangers. After all, the Public Utilities Commission found several of the deadly 2007 firestorms, including the Witch Creek fire, were caused by SDG&E power lines. Construction began on the approximately $435 million project in May 2013, and the substation in Hucumba was completed in June 2014. Construction recently wrapped up on reconstruction and modernization of the Boulevard substation that was built over 60 years ago. Both the Boulevard substation and new 14-mile transmission line connecting the two substations were placed into service last week. The Eco Substation project interconnects with the existing 500-kilovolt Southwest PowerLink transmission project, pumping power into the San Diego marketplace to replace power lost through the decommissioning of the San Onofre nuclear power plants. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio here in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. My very special guest today is Danny Marie, who is a local singer, songwriter, and actress who is making waves on the music scene in San Diego, Memphis, Nashville, and Los Angeles. Folks here in East County may know her as Daniel Marie Pupa. She grew up in Alpine, and since graduating from Steel Canyon High School in East County, she has released an EP. She's got a CD coming out with her Danny Marie Band playing emotional songs that tell a story, or what she describes as pop country that rocks. One of her original songs, Flavor of the Week, was featured in a new movie, Music High, which also featured Danny Marie performing in a high school battle of the bands scene. Her band also won a Golden Reel Award for Best Music Video for Flavor of the Week from the Nevada International Film Festival. The music video had its world premiere at the Memphis International Film and Music Festival in 2013, where Danny Marie and her drummer performed in a music showcase. In addition, she was a backup singer for Itch on his music video, Another Man, and she has an acting role in a movie coming out soon, Past the Light, which will be hitting the theaters in February. Her band has performed at locations in Nashville and Southern California, including the San Diego County Fair, and now Danny Marie is performing solo in local night spots here in San Diego and East County. Danny Marie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
How did you first get involved in music?
I first got involved in music a long time ago when I was 6 years old. I told my mom I really wanted to be a pop star when I grew up, and she had mentioned that, you know, we didn't have really musical genes in our family, so she was awesome, and she took me to singing classes. Upon singing classes, I did musical theater up until high school, and I did show choir, and then for my 16th birthday, my dad gave me a guitar instead of a car, and I learned how to play and fell in love with country music and decided that is what I've wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Good for you. I know you've stated that rock stars don't go to college, which is a pretty bold statement, but
It sounds like your family has been really supportive of your career choice.
Yes. Okay. Rock stars don't go to college. That is a comment that can't be taken out of context, because when I said that, it was my senior year of high school, and we were doing our graduating show choir performance. And at the very end of the show that night, on stage, our show choir teacher came on and was saying how proud of us she was, us seniors. And she said, I'm going to walk around, I'll hand the mic to each senior, and they're going to say what college they're going to. And I immediately found my mom in the audience and locked eyes with her and was like, oh, my gosh, Mom, what do I say? Like, you know, and then when the mic came to me, I didn't know what to say. And so I said, rock stars don't go to college. And the audience cracked up, and I didn't plan on saying that. So no, I do think college is a great thing, but I said that in the moment of, oh my gosh, I'm planning on being a rock star when I grow up, and I don't have plans to go to college. So,
well, it sounds like you're well on your way to getting there. So tell us, how did you get your first big break in the music industry? It's a tough industry to break into for a lot of folks.
Yeah, I feel like big breaks are kind of a funny thing, because I feel like in the end it's all a bunch of little breaks that end up adding up to something huge. But I think one thing that has really made a difference in my career was my song Flavor of the Week getting into the movie Music High, which should be released sometime in the near future. It has some very notable names in the film, and that was just, in my opinion, kind of a God thing. My mom and I were attending a music business seminar, happened to sit next to this guy. We became friends with him. A couple months later, he called us and said, hey, I was doing some music direction for a film, and the director loved your song. Can we proceed from there? And so that was very cool. Not only is the song in the movie, but I got to be in the movie as a guitar player while the actress is lip syncing over my voice, which I thought was so cool. And from there, we did a music video, which will be, you know, part of the DVD when the movie comes out. So
yeah, and then
that
this
was
is
very cool.
The music video that's been just winning awards every place all over. It's very funny. I saw it.
Cool.
I think it's something that really strikes a chord.
Yeah.
It's this theme of the sort of campus Casanova. There hasn't everybody known one of those kind of guys,
right,
where you find out the same love note he gives you, he gave to lots of other girls.
Yeah, absolutely. And that music video was cool because that was a family project. My mom produced it. My dad shot it.
Yeah.
It was my song. So it was cool to have that be a family project.
Yeah, and in the end, Romeo kind of gets what he has coming to him.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's a fun video.
Very good. So what kind of reactions have you gotten to your music from the people that you grew up with, some of the folks in high school? Maybe some of them may have even recognized themselves in the music.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had a lot of people that I went to high school with. I wasn't a cool kid in high school at all. I was definitely like a drama, show choir, you know, geek, nerd, whatever. And so it's kind of cool now to see these people who I wasn't really friends with. Now they're, you know, Facebooking me, and it's super cool. A lot of them will come to my shows, will get my music online. So that's been really neat. And I've definitely had a few friends that have stuck with me through all of it, and regardless of my busy schedule or whatever, have always supported me, and that's really nice.
Very good. I understand that you just recently went to Nashville. How did that go?
Yeah, I love Nashville. I describe it as Disneyland. I feel like it's a magical place. It's so great, from the people to the food to the music. Everything there is just awesome. I went there to record my CD. We did that in August, and that was a really cool experience.
Speaking of Disney, I understand you have a role in a new movie coming out called Past the Light. Tell us about that.
Past the Light is due to come out, I believe, in February of 2015, and that was actually the very first project I worked on when I moved to Los Angeles about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I actually showed up there to do background work the first day, and the producer of the movie ended up keeping five of us kids that were background to work on set almost every day for 2 months. So that was really cool. And my best friends from LA to this day are the people that I met on the set doing that movie.
And was this a Disney movie?
It's not a Disney movie, but a lot of the main characters in it are famous from Disney Channel. So, yeah, but it's very cool. I got to go to the screening, the premiere of it, and it's just a phenomenal movie. I can't wait for it to come out.
Very good. And that's hitting theaters when?
February of 2015.
Past the Light. Okay. Can you tell us where you draw inspiration for the music that you write?
Yeah. I feel like it's different almost every time. Lately, there's been a consistent thing of I'm always looking for hooks. Country music a lot of times is about, you know, the hooks of the song. And so yeah. I'm always listening in my daily conversation. Somebody will say something and I'm like, oh my gosh. And I have a ongoing list in my phone of little things that I write down. And, or sometimes it'll be honestly another song that I hear that I'm just overwhelmed with that certain emotion. And I'll write something, you know, based off that emotion. And I draw a lot of my inspiration from my favorite musicians.
You once said, I love it when people tell me that one of my songs made them cry. Why is that?
I believe if a song is powerful enough to make you cry, then I've done my job as an artist, as a vocalist, as a songwriter. I was recently, it was my plane ride, I believe, back from Nashville when I had been recording there. And I sat next to this guy on the plane. We kind of became friends and very cool guy, you know, like a middle-aged man. And I ended up playing some of my songs for him. And when he heard one song specifically called Here Comes the Bride that I wrote a few years ago, he started crying. And wow. This is this middle-aged man on an airplane. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. And to me, I'm just like, because other songs make me cry. And that's why I love those artists. Mm-hmm. It's not always about crying. It's about having a good time, too. But I just feel accomplished if someone tells me that they cry when they hear my music.
Yeah, your songs tell stories, absolutely. Which certainly comes from the country music genre. And yet they also have sort of a pop flair, rock and roll flair that crosses genres and I think transcends generations, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Which brings us to time to share some of those songs with our listeners. What music would you like us to share with our listeners today, Danny Marie, and can you tell us a little bit about the first song?
Yes. The first song that I would like to share with you is called Anything I Wanna Be, and it is the title track of my record that will be released this upcoming year. Anything I Wanna Be was inspired when I was living in Los Angeles. Living in LA was definitely a really intense experience. There's so many pressures there from the industry, from Hollywood itself, that they put on women to always look airbrushed, to be perfect on the inside and out. Yeah. And even if you're not living up there in the industry, I feel like as a girl, you can totally relate to that because we get that through magazines and through movies and through TV. And I was working really hard up in LA. I was sharing a one-bedroom apartment with three girls. And one day I just sat down and I was looking at myself in the mirror and this song literally just came out. It's one of the very few songs I can just say just came out in an instant.
Okay, so let's listen now to an excerpt from Anything I Want to Be.
Dear Hollywood, I look in the mirror and I see my face. See all the things I wish I could erase. Do I look too fat? Will I ever fit in? Doesn't matter, nobody's listening. Can't find anyone who's just like me. With the scars on my heart that always bleed. Dear Hollywood, one day you'll see I am anything I wanna be. Cause those words that you speak, they just judge and critique. Say give up on my dreams, but I am anything I wanna be. So I'll stand on my feet, live out my destiny, go down in history. Cause I am anything I wanna be.
That was wonderful, Danny Marie. What is the next song that you'd like to share?
The next song is called Counting Down Summertime. I love this song because it's super fun, super upbeat. We like to say it's bro country with a dose of estrogen. Bro country is blowing up the airwaves right now, and I have, you know, I'm obviously a girl, and so it's cool to have maybe bro country with a feminine take on it. This song has a rap at the end, which I love, so it's very upbeat. It's a country party song.
That sounds fascinating. Let's listen to an excerpt now.
Tailgates dropping like the jaws on the boys. When they roll up, see the girls in their jacked up toys. Dirt road dance floor with the cricket soundtrack, firefly disco ball. Oh, when you twirl me like that, last night a summer boy. So let's raise our cups, cause time's flying like the dust we're kicking up. Moon hanging by the eyes like a country clock, shining, sinking, telling us how much time we got. Goodbye to tan lines, pontoons and sunshine. No hitting rewind, counting down summertime. So let's make the most
you so much for sharing that with us, Danny Marie. And you've got one more to share, I understand, called Fix This Broken Heart?
Yes. Sometimes there's somebody in your life that you are absolutely in love with, and you allow them to string you along simply because having a little bit of them is better than having none of them. And so I wrote this song about that, and then finding the strength to have enough confidence in yourself to realize, you know, you're worth more than that. You're worth somebody who will, you know, pursue you and love you equally. And that's what I wrote this song about.
Yeah, that's a very positive theme out of something that I think is a universal emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's listen now to an excerpt from Fix My Broken Heart.
When you said break up, I thought you'd take it back. Instead, you kept your word, gave me a heart attack. But when you called it off, you kept calling me back. Playing hard, tug of war, left me with a scar. I can't move on, I'm paralyzed. When I see those brown eyes, it's like I'm hypnotized. So when you call me, I meet you in the rain, and we dance real slow. Kiss you and your tongue in the dust will blow. Till before two till dawn, wish I'm shooting stars. You keep me hanging, I can fix this broken heart.
Well, you certainly have a lot of talent, Danny Marie. Now, you're doing some local performances. I understand you just played at the B&S Brewery out here in Santee. If people want to come hear you live and in person, where are you playing next?
Yes. I also have a performance coming up at the House of Blues on Tuesday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. in the Voodoo Lounge, also known as the Salvation Alley Stage, and that should be a lot of fun.
Very good. In San Diego. We'll certainly look forward to that. And if listeners want to find out more information about you, Danny Marie, or hear some more of your music online, where can they go?
Yes, my official website is DannyMarie.com. That's DannyMarie.com. And I am a huge Instagram fanatic and Facebook and Twitter. And you can connect with me on all those outlets. My Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter name is LoveDannyMarie.
Wonderful. Well, Danny Marie, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. We appreciate you joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you. It's been a blast.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.